Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. It's a podcast that's part of the New Books Network. On this episode, I'm talking to Antonio Kyler about access, diversity, equity, and inclusion in cultural organizations, insights from the careers of executive opera managers of color in the US. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Dave.
This is an incredibly sort of important book. It's really sort of the moment in terms of major debates in the cultural sector. But it's also a book that is kind of personally quite fascinating, and it's one of those academic books where your investment in the field really comes through. And I think the place to start is with this sense of your kind of personal interest. Why were you interested in writing about opera? What's your sort of your personal history with opera?
Oh, that's such a great question. So I attended a performing arts high school and my area was voice. And I went there as a freshman in high school. And at the time I thought, you know, I'm just going there to improve my singing, but my real aspiration was to become a gospel singer. And so I got exposed to opera, and it really just opened up this whole other world that I was not even aware of, and allowed me to expand my view of what was possible in terms of having a career in the arts and culture. And I definitely remember, especially a story my sophomore year, I had a teacher who taught this music comprehension class, and we were having a discussion about individual opera singers. And he mentioned Jesse Norman and Kathleen Battle. And I had not heard of those two singers. I was aware of Marian Anderson, Roland Hayes. And so he said, you know, you don't know Jesse Norman or Kathleen Battle? I was like, no, I've never heard of them. And so he really allowed me and worked with me to kind of teach me about who they were. But from there, I took that opportunity and took that, you know, that the learning that was gained from that, and went and studied very intently opera singers, including Black opera singers. Black opera singers were the entry point into opera for me. And, you know, Until then, I didn't even know that it was possible. Again, I was aware of Marian Anderson. I remember in middle school reading a Times Magazine article about her when she died. But beyond that, I didn't know the full extent of Black people's participation in opera. And so that's where it started for me in high school. And then I went on to study voice as an undergraduate. And then I went on to, after finishing my bachelor's degree, I decided that I wasn't sure if singing was the right place for me in opera. And so I thought, oh, I'll get a degree in arts administration at the suggestion of my voice professor, who said, you managed your senior recital so well that I think you should pursue a career in arts administration. And so I went to graduate school for arts admin, and with the intent of becoming an artistic administrator, I wanted to have power around casting operas and auditioning operas, because I thought, you know, I had a very good understanding of the voice. And even I remember my junior year in college, I planned to take opera lit, and I had a professor say to me, why in the world are you taking that course? You could teach the course. So I had this encyclopedic knowledge about opera and classical music, and I needed something to do with it beyond singing. And so I became interested in opera management and how that can be an opportunity as well for Black, Indigenous, and people of color.
I mean, that early experience, and I guess that almost sort of lack of profile around in the initial case, opera singers of color, but I guess people of color more generally, in opera as a genre and art form, as an industry, really gestures towards, I guess, the kind of problem that opera has. And what the book does really well kind of early on is say, well, actually, you know, currently there are issues around racial equity in opera, but actually this is a kind of longer historical issue. And I suppose the sort of the question that comes to mind is not just the sort of what's the problem with opera, but I guess where does your interest in researching this and almost kind of researching for change relate to that problem?
Well, you know, it started with my own personal journey. As I was completing my master's degree in arts administration and having completed, you know, big summer internships with Central City Opera, the Spoleto Festival USA, Wolf Trap, you know, I chose very specifically internships that I thought would advance my career in opera. And then as I was wrapping up my master's degree, the association, the service or trade association here in the States that is related to and connected to opera and ensuring opera's production and distribution and enjoyment, they used to have these fellowship programs. And I applied for a fellowship program, and they had this kind of like three-pronged process by which applicants were considered. And so what would happen is you'd have the first kind of stage of the process was you submitting your application. And then the second stage was to go and visit with an opera executive who was working at an opera company near you. And that person assessed if you were ready to move on to the third level. And, you know, they determined if you got to move on in the process for consideration for a fellowship. And I thought, okay, I have a bachelor's degree in voice. I have, I'm finishing a master's degree in arts administration. I've developed this knowledge where I worked in the opera department at Florida State, and I did these internships at Central City Opera, Spoleto Festival USA, Wolf Trap Opera. Like, I thought I had, you know, effectively curated the profile of someone who would be successful in one of these fellowship programs. And what happened was I wasn't selected. And to this day, I'm not exactly sure why I wasn't selected, but it was an eye-opening experience to be credentialed and to have this experience. And actually, the one piece of feedback I remember receiving was the person who I met with didn't think I had enough experience, which, you know, it's irritating in a way, because I'm like, well, I have a bachelor's and a master's and then these like strong internships plus whatever experience I had from those internships and my graduate assistantships. But then also the idea that wasn't that the job of the fellowship to give me the kind of experience that he was saying that I lacked? And so, you know, personally, it kind of opened up this door for me to wonder, well, how often are people who are historically and continuously oppressed kept out of spaces because of language like you don't have the right experience, or you don't have any experience, or what other ways that we make up or reasons we make up to keep people excluded and to keep people out of these opportunities. And so that was my own personal experience, really kind of opened the door for me to ask these questions from a researcher's perspective, because I also begin to wonder, you know, well, how much more experience do I need? Who do I have to be to chart a path towards the executive level management experience in opera? What else do I need to know? Who else do I need to know? What kind of social networking do I need to have? And so another thing that that experience did for me was it caused me to pivot from kind of pursuing this professional career as an arts manager or opera manager into becoming an academic and a scholar, and observing, looking, asking questions, interrogating some of the experiences that people were having.
And you've done that in a very, I suppose, sort of particular way by drawing on very detailed career interviews with some really crucial respondents. And I'm sort of wondering in terms of the balance of the book, you know, there's so much in the interviews and how to sort of do them justice. But perhaps we'll try and do as many as we can in the time. The approach the book takes, I suppose, both asks the interviewees to do a sort of, you know, career kind of retrospective almost, but at the same time draws out really crucial findings around how success functions, what sort of things are necessary in terms of mentorship, networks, the need for almost, you know, things like luck in careers. And I guess within that, each, I don't know if you did this intentionally, but each story has a almost a slightly different focus. And if we start with Henry Akina, I think, if I pronounce that correctly, one of the things that really stood out reading his story was initially he kind of told a story about not actually wanting to be involved. And it was interesting, if we're reflecting on kind of, you know, success or access, why you chose a story of someone being like, well, maybe this isn't for me to begin with.
Yeah. You know, Mr. Akina, so I started the book in 2005 as my dissertation study. And so 2005 and 2017 or 18, when I got to interview him, there was lots of time that had passed. And, you know, thinking longitudinally about like a qualitative study, because I wondered how much change would happen between when I started collecting the data for the dissertation initially versus, you know, what's happening right now and what was happening right before the racial reckoning of 2020. And I had no idea at the time that, my work would have such resonance and be compelling in that way. What I did have an inkling of, and I'm not a prophet and I don't have any mystical powers, but that this conversation around diversity, equity, and inclusion, or ADEI, as I call it, access, diversity, equity, and inclusion, would be on this kind of like cyclical trope where we would continuously return to it because we weren't addressing it. And so with Mr. Akina, he was very adamant about not wanting to participate, so much so that Michael Ching, who's also in the book, when we spoke, he said, if you want me to, I can make sure that he participates in the study. And I said, you know, no, I think it's okay. You and Willie Anthony Waters and Linda Jackson have given me what I needed. And so I'm just going to wait and return to it once I've allowed the dissertation to sit for a few years and see what happens. And so when I revisited the conversation with him, he was so generous. He was so appreciative for me reaching back out to him. And he said, he actually apologized and said at the time, I was just kind of frustrated around this question and this topic of diversity and how people were addressing it. And I now understand the importance of what you were trying to do at the time.
I mean, it's, you said there you're not a prophet, and it's interesting, isn't it, the if not cyclical nature of these questions, but effectively the stickiness of them, you know, that despite, you know, some rhetorical interventions from key organizations, questions of access, diversity, equity, and inclusion just really never go away, particularly in various, I suppose, kind of elite art forms and within elite professions. And some of the, I guess, the kind of stories that you've collected through the interviews are stories of success. And in some ways, you know, if someone was looking to think about, well, how do I navigate my way through, there are things that we can learn in terms of success. And Tori Allen's story, I think, is one of those kind of interesting success stories, because what I teased out from that was the sense of, you don't really need an opera background to kind of make it. You know, it's not going to be the you know, the be all and sort of end all. But interestingly, at the same time, there was a real kind of immersion in the world of opera that came through that story.
Yeah. And especially how he just kind of, that gets to the serendipity of it, right? That someone can fall into it based on their artistic talent and not even know that maybe they have this managerial and leadership capability as a result of you know, wanting to transition and do something different. And so I definitely think that Tori's narrative is supportive of the idea of serendipity, but also from a cultural organization standpoint, it speaks so importantly to why arts education is important, because there are other folks who need cultural organizations to be interventions for helping them to understand how they too can live a creative and expressive life through arts and culture. And whether that be opera or orchestras or ballet or, you know, other art forms that we consider quote unquote high, at this point, I feel like it's all high. It's all important. It's all, you know, I'm done for the love of humanity. And so, yeah, you know, Tori was, and I maintained a very good professional relationship with him. In fact, Tori, we are working on a book proposal in which he's planning to contribute a few book chapters on related to arts fundraising right now. And so his story is definitely one of those that I point to when people are seeking advice about, well, how do I navigate this space? And especially since cultural organizations in the United States right now, post George Floyd, are trying to find Black, Indigenous executives and managers of color.
I mean, that moment is particularly fascinating, and it makes me think, actually, we'll skip Wayne Brown and we'll come back to Wayne Brown and the idea of mentorship. But one of the things that came out of Michael Ching's chapter was this comment right at the very end, where he talks about arts administration as a kind of hidden field. And this sits, I suppose, quite uneasily with the idea that organizations are really attempting, you know, to do much broader recruitment and have a much more diverse set of arts administrators, of arts managers. And I wonder if you could kind of unpack that idea of arts administration being a hidden field. What was Michael meaning by that? And I guess, what does it tell us about arts administration as a set of professions?
Yeah, well, you know, I think what Michael meant by that when he said that is, it's kind of that whole good old boy kind of practice or the practice of nepotism. If you know about it, then you can get in and almost exploit the opportunity to maximize its potentiality for success for you. And so I think it is people don't always think about what happens behind the scenes. And the way in which a lot of us, I think, are even attracted to arts and culture is through the performance aspect or the exhibiting aspect, the artistic aspects of arts and culture is what becomes a lot of our entry points. I came into arts and culture by singing gospel music at church, right? That was my entry point into exploring the full possibilities and the vastness of possibilities available to me through arts and culture. It started with gospel music, which was at home, but also at church. And so, you know, Michael, I think, touched on something that was very important, is that arts administration, arts management remains even to this day, to an extent, a hidden field, because they're in comparison to degree programs around specific arts practices, there are less degree programs for arts management and cultural policy, arts leadership, and those kinds of things. And so it's kind of funny when people ask me what I do. I even remember when I was trying to explain my dissertation topic to my dad, and I said to him, you know, have you ever gone to a concert or gone to a museum and had the experience of arts and culture and wondered who decided what you were going to see or what you were going to hear? And so he said, yes. And I was like, well, I teach people how to do that. That's what I do. And so, and I think we've made some progress towards opening up the field and letting people know that it exists. But I've had several friends who all identify as people of the global majority. They might be of African descent or Asian descent, who said if they had known about arts management or arts leadership, you know, when they were going through their undergraduate or graduate studies, they would have pursued that path. And so, you know, when you hear that, it's disturbing to me, because I'm wondering, well, what can the, like, you know, educational associations like the European Network of Cultural Administration Training Centers, or the Association of Arts Administration Educators, or the Southeastern Arts Leadership Association, what can they do to make arts management, arts leadership, arts administration more visible to more people?
I mean, it sounds sort of trite to say one of the things within this is mentorship. And I think actually that, you know, this is in the book a little bit, and more broadly in the field, there are lots of problems with the idea of mentorship being able to kind of fix every structural issue that we find in the arts. But mentorship is clearly one of those ways that people get involved in that, you know, slightly hidden network, that slightly hidden world of nepotism. And Wayne Brown, you know, sort of raised it in the conversation. It was clearly important. And to an extent, it's important to everybody you talk to. But it really stood out in Wayne Brown's narrative. So I wonder if you could say a bit about why mentorship matters.
Yeah, you know, I think that is probably the biggest takeaway from the book, is that folks who explicitly and candidly describe the benefits of mentorship for them individually. At the time, only Tory was actively mentoring the next generation or the next generations of people who could potentially become opera managers and executive opera managers of color. And so, you know, there was, in my discussion with Wayne, I was a bit... How do I describe this diplomatically? Because he explicitly said at one point in our interview that he did not just want to mentor potential Black administrators, which I understand, right? As an educator, I want to be a mentor for a variety of students and a variety of people. And I would never want to limit someone to only mentoring people who are like them. But the benefits that he expressed himself for having mentors who were like him, for him to not be able to see how that could be instrumental to advancing the careers of other people who look like him at the time, I was disturbed by that. But what it also revealed to me from a researcher standpoint was that people's racial identity development processes are different. And there is a generational lens that comes along with that, right? Most of the participants in the book were baby boomers. And so baby boomers got to benefit from affirmative action policies, even if they had a negative reaction to the idea that affirmative action may have assisted them in their career paths. Almost all of them expressed a negative reaction to affirmative action. But at the same time, I don't think that they all understood that affirmative action at the core of the policy is the suggestion that white people are not always, it's not even possible that white people can always be the right choice for every single job. Statistically speaking, it's just not possible. And so affirmative action actually opens the door and says, okay, if white people are not always the best possible person for a job, how do we identify, recruit, and retain people who are not white, people who are of the global majority? And so what I would like to share is I was very, very pleased that this year, earlier this year in April, there is a group that has emerged as a collective, and they identify themselves as the Black Administrators of OPERA. And I was very pleased to learn that Wayne Brown and Athan Battle, who is a new Black female executive OPERA manager after Linda Jackson, she's the second, they were able to have a mentorship session with this group, and that Wayne actively participated in that, because I feel like it was a complete turnaround from where he was when we spoke in 2017. And so I don't know what caused the change, but I like to hypothesize or theorize that the racial reckoning of 2020 and that we are still experiencing to some extent maybe helped to cause the evolution of his thinking about that.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I was struck that you'd mentioned the sort of complexity of racial consciousness. And one of the things that was really brilliant, I think, about Linda Jackson's chapter and actually the overall conversation you'd had with her was the way she was able to bring in things like, well, what about sexism in OPERA and, you know, more broadly in the world of arts administration. And that intersection of racism and sexism, I think, is something that, is occasionally a risk that gets maybe put to one side or left out when we're discussing questions of access in the arts. But she was able to give, I think, quite a nuanced and quite powerful narrative around it. So I'm trying to formulate this as a question that isn't just tell me about Linda Jackson, because it sounded fascinating.
Yeah, you know, you're right. I appreciate and love how she held the space as the only woman of color at the time when I was collecting the data who held an executive position or had held an executive position with an opera company. And I love that I didn't get the sense when I was speaking with her that being Black or being woman was more important, that they were equally important. And when Kimberly Crenshaw talks about intersectionality, I think Linda's narrative is a perfect example of that, because she spoke to some of the very nuanced kind of targeted experiences that she had as a Black woman. And it almost, to me, said that, you know, if you were an Asian woman or an Indigenous woman, your experiences dealing with racism and sexism will be different. And I think that's a fair assessment and argument to make, that when we're thinking about addressing historic and continuous oppression, we have to think about it intersectionally. Right now, I'm working on some on a study where I'm thinking about how do we identify those people who are historically and continuously oppressed across all social identities. A person who is queer, trans, poor, and of color is going to have a different story to tell about what it means to be human than someone who may be historically or continuously oppressed by one of their social identities or none of their social identities. And so how do we identify those folks and empower and support them in telling what their stories are? Because the linking intersectional identities means then that their oppression is compounding, you know, quadruply compounded in some cases. And so for me also, I think if that's happening, then the depthness in which they can tell us about what it means to be human is even greater. It's even greater. And so I am always thinking about, even when I'm doing survey research, how can we lift up the voices of the most historically and continuously marginalized and oppressed and take their voices, center them in a way that we can create policies and practices that uplift them. And by uplifting them, we can uplift all of us.
I mean, that's one of the great lessons of the book, I think. And one of the things I was going to ask you was for these sort of general lessons that you've teased out of the interviews. But before that, and you know, I sort of think it would be a shame to miss the story that Maestro Willie Walters told you, but it's an interesting juxtaposition with what you've just been saying, because in some ways the Maestro story was, this sounds terrible, but he kind of got lucky, you know, or he was in the right place at the right time. He was able to kind of respond to opportunities. And at the same time as the work of kind of lifting up and representing, I suppose there's also the question about how do you make sure people are in situations where they can get lucky, where they can respond to possibilities and opportunities. So how did luck figure in the Maestro's career?
Yeah, you know, you call it luck and I call it serendipity, which I think are essentially the same thing, that sometimes there are things outside of our control that pushes us in particular directions. And the thing is, I think, how do you teach people to be responsive and sensitive to serendipities, trying to push them in the right direction? Because I think in all of those cases, all six of those folks' narratives, serendipity played a point and a part. None of them said that they intentionally sought out the executive career path in opera. Not one of them, right? And so I've taught students who are of the global majority who have sought out a career path that will lead them to the executive suite. And those students have faced some barriers, some challenges. And I thought, you know, as people of the global majority, and this was, again, this was before summer of 2020's racial reckoning, where I thought, oh, things have changed enough for the millennials that they won't have the same challenges to an accessing career options and career possibilities that would chart them on the path towards executive leadership, if that's what they aspire to do. And some of my students, just some of the stories that they told me about some of the things that they face, some of the racialized microaggressions. And these are, in my view, students who were solidly positioned to take advantage of all of the opportunities available to them that would help them along the way. And so, but I think one of the missing pieces for those folks were mentorship, and mentorship that was cross-cultural, but also mentorship by folks who look like them. And so, for example, I have a former student who I thought she was going to be able to do amazing things. I taught her at SUNY Purchase, and I think so highly of her. And I'm still like, you know, but she's been traumatized by some of the racial microaggressions that she faced. And, you know, she even spoke out about some of those things once the racial reckoning opened up the possibility for conversations and contrition and forgiveness and discussions to happen where people might be invited back into the fold with new experiences. And so I was recently speaking with her about a possibility, and I was so grateful that she responded to it, because I think she's one of the next leaders, and I'm just trying to figure out how to get her in the right place with the right social network, so that she can have the same experience. And you know, Maestro Waters, he identified those mentors. And even though serendipity was there kind of nudging him along, and it wasn't, you know, necessarily a career that he kind of sought out, it came to him. And I just wish that there was a way to help people who don't know that they want this, connect with it. And I think that's the big challenge. And I think mentorship is a way to do that. It's a part of the equation, or a part of the recipe for success in arts management in general, but especially in opera. Opera can be, and this is, you know, coming from me where I love opera. I listen to opera often. I studied it. I've made several, you know, big sacrifices and investments to understand this art form. But I understand how opera can be very cliquish and very exclusionary. And, you know, if you don't know the right singers or the right folks, it can be a very difficult space to navigate. And so I think that Maestro Waters' story reflects very well what happens when serendipity meets mentorship, and that becomes a part of the equation for career success.
The final chapter basically does what you've just done there. It summarizes various of the lessons, the both, you know, kind of markers for success, but also barriers to success, and it tries to really synthesize these stories into a broader reflection on access, diversity, equity, and inclusion in opera. And you've mentioned actually that some of the specific dynamics of opera, but more broadly into the cultural sector. And as we conclude, but before we maybe pick up on what you're working on now, what do you think some of the lessons overall are in terms of where opera is going and where the cultural sector might be, both in terms of post 2020, but I suppose, are we likely to be coming back in another decade, in another 15 years, where I might be asking you about a book you've written with almost exactly the same career stories, but with younger people? Or are there things that are likely to come from these career stories that are going to generate real long-lasting change?
Yeah, I hope that it is the latter. But I think what's going to happen is that it's a variation on a theme where we have to be so diligent about keeping our eye on the target, because the target is a shapeshifter. It morphs into something else, but it doesn't really change. It only appears to change. And so I will say, you know, since I wrote the book, and as you said, I you know, with qualitative research, it can be difficult to synthesize across narratives, because what you want is for a naturalistic generalization to happen where the reader constructs their own meaning and their learning from the cases and what they would bring from all of the cases together. And so, mentorship is so important. And I continue to advocate for mentorship and intergenerational mentorship, because I think that just because a person is older and maybe more experienced or may have more status does not mean that they cannot also learn from someone who is younger. And so I think that a mentorship model that acknowledges that fact could be beneficial for moving more historically and continuously marginalized and oppressed folks forward together. The racial identity development piece is something that I'm still actually reflecting on to this day, is how do we make space for a capacious space for and grace and compassion for the multiplicity of ways that people understand their racial identities and how their racial identity intersects with other historically and continuously marginalized identities. Because sometimes, there was it was Zora Neale Hurston who said that some skin folk are not kinfolk, right? So just because a person might look like a person of the global majority, or they might be melanated in a particular kind of way, does not mean that they think a certain kind of way. And so one of the examples I give is that, for example, in the United States, we have Black Republicans. Even though most Black Americans vote as Democrats, there are Black Republicans, and I'm a Black independent, for example. And so it is a fact that you cannot expect for all melanated people or all people of the global majority to think the same way, because they're not the same way. Even if they share, the racial identity and the longitudinal historic or continuous trauma that comes along with having that racial identity, people process that and understand it in different ways and react and respond to it in different ways. So for me, I'm uncomfortable being a barrier to other people of the global majority coming into the field. But there are some people of the global majority who have understood that some cultural organizations and the creative sector to a certain degree is going to tokenize. And so they would rather be the token and be a gatekeeper through being the token versus being a part of opening the space up to as many people of the global majority as is possible, so that more of us can come in and do the work of helping cultural organizations and the creative sector better understand the experiences of people who are historically and continuously marginalized and oppressed, as well as what that could mean for providing more resonant, culturally responsive, and culturally relevant arts experiences for more people. And then, one of the things that I'm very fascinated by now is, what effects does racial discrimination have on the U.S. creative economy? And starting with that broader question around race, of course, opens up a research agenda that may allow us to consider the ways that marginalization and oppression affect the creative economy in general. And there are three studies that brought me to this question. In 2020, Citibank did a study and learned that over a 20-year period, the U.S. economy lost $16 trillion as a result of anti-Black racism. There was a study by Georgetown professors about higher education. Racial inequity cost the U.S. economy about $956 billion annually. And then there was a study that was done on Hollywood, and anti-Black racism in Hollywood cost the industry $10 billion annually. And so when I think about the nonprofit creative sector and creative economy, which is constantly, talking about being underfunded and lacking money or lacking financial resources, how in the world can you rationalize discrimination, marginalization, oppression, and subjugation when there are financial implications or economic implications for the perpetuation of racial discrimination and oppression of all kinds.
You'd mentioned, I mean, there is a really obvious research agenda in there, but will that coalesce into a future book? Is there a chance to return to some of the work on opera? Where are you going to go next?
Absolutely. So I am currently working on my second solo authored book, and it's called Achieving Creative Justice in the U.S. Creative Sector. And so I am recontextualizing Mark Banks's work on creative justice in the U.S. through the lens of access, diversity, equity, and inclusion, and trying to operationalize in a very practical way how cultural organizations and creative sectors can be agents and actors to living a creative and expressive life for historically and continuously marginalized and oppressed people. I've also written a few book chapters. One, Moving Beyond Opera as Races, was recently published in a volume on music, labor, and inequality. I have a second book chapter that is coming out in a book where I am interviewing the space moderator and the initiator of the Black administrators of opera. So in this kind of post George Floyd period, I'm trying to use phenomenology to document and explore some of the changes that are happening and as a result of that. And so I'm also currently working on a chapter that's looking at or using Afrofuturism to talk about the ways in which Black people are writing themselves into the future of classical music and opera. Let's see, what else am I working on? Oh, I'm working with the League of American Orchestras on a report on race, ethnic, and gender diversity in orchestras. I'm working on another report for the Hewlett Foundation around arts leadership in the Bay Area. And, you know, anyone who reads my work will see that there is a theme of, you know, race, gender, and those social identities and how they come into play throughout all of these things, because I don't feel like there's enough work in our fields that do that. And so I want to be a part of modeling that. I want to be a part of bringing forth, you know, emerging researchers and showing them a pathway or encouraging them along a pathway that do more of that work and bring more of that kind of analyses to our conversations around arts management and cultural policy.